To what can I compare this generation? They are like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling out to others. He played the flute for you, but you did not dance. He sang a dirge, but you did not mourn. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is proved right by her actions.
Lovely, thank you. And now we turn to page 1082. And Dorothy is going to read for us. 1082, and it's John 15, verse 5.
I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me, and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me, and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be given you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. This is my command. Love each other.
Some of you may remember, many years ago, a singer called Susan Maughan. Anyone remember Susan Maughan? Some of you do. Excellent. The name Susan dates her. There was a time when every little girl was called Susan, Jill, Linda or Sandra. But now they're virtually extinct as names, so that, as I say, dates her a bit. And in early 1963, she had her one big hit, namely Bobby's Girl, yes. I wanna be... I won't sing it to you. I'll spare you the torture. Anyway, I was a great admirer of Susan Maughan. She was my pin-up for a brief period, so I had a poster of Susan Maughan on my bedroom wall, and I was a great admirer particularly of her extraordinarily large beehive hairdo. Do you remember sort of beehive hairdo? Yes. Back combing. Can't be done now. So I had this poster of Susan Maughan. Now, during her brief period of fame, she appeared once or twice on Sunday night at the London Palladium. And I read an article, probably in the Radio Times, as that was the only magazine we got, describing that she'd stayed in a hotel near the London Palladium, and the morning afterwards she'd got up early and gone swimming in the Marshall Street swimming baths, which are just round the corner from the London Palladium. So the very next Saturday, I put my trunks and a roll of towel, off I went to the Marshall Street baths in order to swim in the same water as Susan Maughan, which I duly did. Later that year, I was rather sort of fickle, I think, in my admiration, because later that year I swam off the Cobb at Lyme Regis, because Susanna York, the wonderful Susanna York, had swum there while making the film Tom Jones. So there we are. Now, these kind of adolescent desires and fantasies are always slightly embarrassing in retrospect, but this one is made slightly less embarrassing by means of a book I've recently come across by a man called Charles Sprawson. And he spent his life swimming in places where famous people had swum. So, for example, he had a particular obsession with the playwright Tennessee Williams. And he swam in the Lido in Venice, Santa Monica in California, Barcelona, all because Tennessee Williams had swum in those places. And he even went to Florida. Tennessee Williams had a house in the Florida Keys, right sort of down at the bottom, and a swimming pool. Well, the house had been abandoned and the swimming pool was overgrown with tropical sort of growth and green slime. But not to be daunted, Charles Sprawton insisted on diving in because Tennessee Williams would have swum there. Another of his obsessions was a man called Aleister Crowley, who made a fortune selling sort of spurious spiritual teaching to the rich and famous. This is back in the 1930s. And to prove how wonderfully holy he was, he set himself up as this little sort of teaching place in the Himalayas and claimed to have swum in all sorts of ice-cold Himalayan lakes and streams, showing, as I say, how holy he was. So Charles Sprawson insisted on going to the Himalayas to swim in exactly the same places. However, the really most dangerous thing he ever did was all to do with Tarzan. You remember the actor that played Tarzan? Johnny Weissmuller, exactly. And you can remember all those scenes where there was a rope that he swung on, and there was a lake below with alligators, and there was Jane. Do you remember those scenes? Of course you do. Now, originally, when they first made the Tarzan films, the alligators were made of rubber. Didn't look very realistic. So then they got real alligators that had their teeth surgically removed. Oh, I know, very cruel. Which led to Johnny Weissmuller speculating on how he might be gummed to death. But anyway, that's what happened, and they made the films, and there was these toothless alligators, and eventually that was the end of Tarzan. They stopped making the films. Well, 30 or 40 years later, Charles Sprawson thought he must find that lake and swim in it. So he found it, and he dived in. He hadn't reckoned on the fact that those alligators without teeth had given birth to alligators with teeth. So he was chased by alligators, eager to have him for lunch. But he just escaped, and he lived to tell the tale and write the book. Now, Charles Sprawson is quite clear that, in his view, these experiences were sort of spiritual, that somehow through the water he was communing with the people he loved and admired. And I can sort of identify with that a little bit. Back in 1962... my parents took my brothers and me on our first Mediterranean holiday, all the way to the Aegean, northern Aegean. We stayed on two little islands, Skathos and Skyros, and you had to get to them by little sort of cargo ships that plied the islands. And eventually we arrived in Skyros, snorkel, goggles, and it's the first time swimming in a warm sea. And you swim off the rocks. And I was totally entranced, looking with my goggles and my snorkel, at the marine life. The sheer colour, vibrancy, variety of it completely entranced me. I spent hours and hours, got very burnt back, just looking at this marine life, and felt that somehow, because there was the water joining it and me, I felt, I didn't use this word in my mind, but I felt in some way I was part of it all. I was part of that life. So I can kind of identify with what Charles Sprawson was saying. Now, I'm not about to suggest that we all take the next flight to the Sea of Galilee and start swimming there, because, of course, Jesus would have put at least his feet in the Sea of Galilee as he got onto fishing boats. I am not about to suggest that. But I do think there's an important point in all this, that our relationship with Jesus, our worship of Jesus, is physical as well as spiritual. And let me try and explain. When God chose to reveal himself to mankind, he could have sent a book, a philosophy book or theology book, full of propositions and corollaries and arguments and so on, a kind of dry theology. It could have contained all necessary for salvation. He could have done it that way, but he didn't. He sent a person, Jesus Christ. A flesh and blood person, just like us, who eats and drinks, goes to sleep, wakes up, who has friends. He laughs and jokes with his friends. He tells stories about everyday things, ordinary material things. All the stories are wise, many amusing. And then when his friends are worried, he put a reassuring hand on their shoulder. If they're in great distress, he might embrace them. Flesh and blood, Jesus Christ, just like us in all material respects. And through the Gospels, which are so wonderfully vivid, we can be taken back in our imagination to be with him. We can relate to him physically as well as spiritually. And I think that's tremendously important, enormously important, in fact. Now, that takes me back to my experience looking at marine life in the Mediterranean. I can remember particularly watching the seaweed, the little growth at the bottom, swaying this way and that way in the current. And I could feel the same current on my own body, seeming to caress me. And that's a way of, and it's suggested to me by somebody I'm going to mention in a moment, a way of thinking about this physical relationship with Jesus. He caresses us. We can feel his warmth, his embrace, a caress. And that caress carries a tremendous promise, the promise that we will rise again, not only spiritually, but physically. Christianity is a physical as well as a spiritual religion. That is the promise. We shall be healed, made perfect, physically as well as spiritually. The caress of Jesus will be with us for all eternity. Now, let me mention two other figures in relation to sort of swimming about and so on. One is a person that Sarah and I met on a little ferry boat going out from the west coast of Ireland to little island, Clare Island, about 5 miles out in the Atlantic. It's been so rough the previous days because some sort of hurricane from Florida had sort of fetched up in Ireland. I don't quite know how. Anyway, the ferry hadn't been working, but then was working, but the waves were still very high. And so we were bobbing about on the waves trying to get out to this island. Now, there was one other person with us, a man about our sort of age, and his wife had died a few years previously, and he had scattered her ashes in the Atlantic. Which is incidentally where Sarah and I want our ashes to be scattered. Every day he would take his car or a bus or a train, something he'd get, to another little beach or cove where he could swim. Whatever the weather, however rough the sea, and the sea was very rough and the rain was horizontal, he would go to find a cove and bathe. And he felt by that, and he's a very devout Christian, he felt in that way he was in communion with his wife, through the water, and with God. The sea, as it were, represented heaven for him, and the currents were, albeit sometimes very rough, but were God's caress. And it's from him I got that idea that God, that Jesus, caresses us, embraces us. Now, let me mention another person who's also mentioned in Sprawson's book, a man called Charlie Moore. You won't have heard of him. He was a working-class chap, served in the army in the late 19th century, ordinary private soldier, and on one occasion, in a battle, had his leg blown off. So he was one-legged. Got back to England and taught himself to swim, one-legged. And the motion he acquired was that of a fish, because a fish, in a sense, is one-legged. I mean, it's a silly way of putting it, but so he would be able to swim through the water like that, just like a fish. And it was suggested to him, and he took this up, that he created a little pool in Blackpool where people could watch him swim. And he was the famous merman, mermaid, merman. And he made an honest, as a reasonable living as a merman. But he too was a devout Christian. And at the end of each performance, of his merman performance, he would give the spectators all around him a little sermon. And the sermon was this. He thanked God for making him whole by blowing off his leg. He was grateful that that's what had happened. He felt God was in that, and God had given him this particular vocation of swimming and then preaching. So wholeness comes in very strange forms. Actually, Charles Sprawson went off to bathe off Blackpool Pier because he felt somehow he was communing with this old man, Charlie Moore, who had been the merman. Now, I think that's very touching. That he felt he was made whole by losing a leg. Now, I dare say that most of you, perhaps all of you, have a physical image of Jesus in your mind. Is that true of most of you? Yes, I think it probably is. I certainly do. And I've had that image from before I became a Christian, right through, well, the same image until actually a few months ago, when quite involuntarily it changed. I don't know why, but God obviously wanted to give me another image of his son. And there's an important point there. There's nothing in the gospel, in the Bible, that tells us anything about the physical appearance of Jesus. We know his age. His ministry was between the age of 30 and 33. But as for his appearance, we know nothing. And I think that's deliberate. Because God is saying you can have the image of Jesus that suits you, that meets your spiritual needs. And if you don't have an image at the moment, pray for one. Pray for an image of the Father, too. I have a most wonderful image of God the Father that comforts me day by day. Pray for an image. And once you've got the image, this is what to do. Sit down with Jesus. Just sit with him. And what greater joy and privilege can there be than sitting beside the Saviour of the world? Our country is full of surprises, not just that we occasionally get through to the semi-finals of the World Cup, but there's odd sort of other social features. And one of them that I've only discovered in the last year or two is that Luton has a large community of Ghanaians. And there's very few Ghanaians elsewhere, but they've all, apart from Ghana, of course, but they've all congregated in Luton. And they have the Ashanti tribe, which is the main Ghanaian tribe, has not just one queen, but several queens. And one of the queens was living in Luton. And by a strange quirk of fate, providence, God's providence, I got to know her. And very old, and she was more or less bedridden, and I used to go and see her. And she would call me Coffee, because my first meeting, she asked me what day of the week I was born. And I said, Friday. And apparently, there's a special name you have for whatever day of the week you're born. And if you're born on a Friday, you're Coffee. So I was Coffee. And we had lovely meetings together. She's a beautiful person, very devout Christian. Anyway, she's now died. And they've asked me to give the funeral eulogy. And there's people flying in from Ghana and America who'll give sort of further things, but I'll give the sort of initial eulogy. And I went to see the daughter the other day, who's also just been crowned a queen, by the way. This is quite easy, I think, to get crowned a queen. I asked her why... It's next Saturday, the whole event. I asked her why it's starting at such an early hour of 9 o'clock. To which her reply, oh, well, the cemetery closes at 1.